You are listening to an episode from the Women's Collective Archive, brought to you by the Women's Radio Collective at CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Coast Salish Territories.
I'm speaking with Rachel Phillips, who is the Executive Director of Peers at Victoria Resource Society, who spoke as a witness to the Justice Committee hearings on Bill C-36, the Protection of Communities and the Exploited Persons Act. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Hi. So I would just like to lay the foundation for listeners who might not be aware of the issue. Last December, the existing laws around sex work were struck down, specifically laws around keeping or being in a body house, living off the avails of prostitution, and communicating in public for the reasons of prostitution. These were deemed unconstitutional under the Charter by threatening sex workers' rights to life, liberty, and security of the person. So in response to this, the government proposed Bill C-36. Can you explain what Bill C-36, the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, is?
Sure. I'll just say, to back it up a little bit, so the government struck down those three provisions, and they were some of the main ones that I think affected adult sex industry workers, but there are still laws related to prostitution that were left on the books. Mm-hmm. So people talk about how it effectively decriminalized prostitution in Canada, and it didn't entirely. Like things like procurement related to minors, trafficking, they were all remained illegal even after those three provisions were struck down. So the government didn't necessarily have to do anything. They had 12 months to revise them or to revise the laws if they wanted to, but they could have just left those laws struck down, actually. Mm. But they did choose to draft Bill C-36. And Bill C-36, in its preamble, it states that all people in the sex industry, they refer to them as prostituted women, are victims, that their aim is to eradicate the sex industry in Canada, and that's the basis from which they've. And so the laws, they prohibit the purchase of sexual services in entirety. Mm-hmm. They prohibit application for selling sexual services in public. And now on revision in the Justice Committee, that's been reduced to you can't use sexual services in the name of park, mm-hmm. daycare park or playground or school. I can't remember what it was, but it was three sort of obvious places where children would be. Mm-hmm. And so under those circumstances, someone who's a sex worker could be arrested. Then they also criminalized advertising. They also criminalized material benefits. So they made some exceptions around material benefits. So if you're the child, what they consider an illegitimate living arrangement, or someone who sex worker is morally obligated to, you can receive funds. So it's a little bit different than living off the avails, because none of those people were had any kind of immunity before, but now they do, and it's sort of stated in Bill C-36. And also, if you offer services so to the general public, like, for example, an accountant, and you were hired by a sex worker, and you can sort of show that your services are to the sex worker are comparable to the rates you offer to the general public, then you would also be exempted from the material benefit law. Okay. But otherwise, material benefit can cover anyone that provides a support service to the sex industry, mm-hmm. and it specifically also criminalizes there is no material benefit or support services that can be legitimately offered in the context of what they call a commercial enterprise. Mm-hmm. So it criminalizes laws. I'm not even sure if it actually potentially affects some sort of erotic dance clubs and things like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so those are some of the main contours of what's been criminalized. Okay. So, yeah.
You were invited to speak, and so I wanted to know what Pierre's statement was towards this bill.
Yeah, so we submitted a brief when the bill came out in early June, and then we prepared a presentation when we got invited to be witnesses. Mm-hmm. And the presentation actually is available on our Facebook page if you actually wanted to read it. And so the written presentation is as well as the recorded TV recorded from CPAC. So essentially what we said is we oppose the bill in entirety. We advocated for a decriminalized environment as being more likely to support the health and wellness. We sort of outlined who we are as an organization, the fact that we support sex workers from a diversity of backgrounds, that indeed our clients' perspectives on the sex industry are very diverse, and we have to work with those diverse perspectives. But overall, people, our clientele, and we've held some focus groups and we've consulted with people, nobody sees how criminalization is really supposed to benefit them. And very few people would, like, wholeheartedly regard themselves as victims in the sex industry. Like, people are exercising various degrees of agency. There's, they may have limited options in their lives, but, you know, being cast as fundamentally a victim is not something people would necessarily, even if, you know, their lives may look like things, they're quite vulnerable, they're quite marginalized, people are still exercising agency. Doing the best they can. So the preamble just doesn't fit for us as an organization and what we know about the sex industry and people in the sex industry. So we kind of outlined, according to some of the provisions, some of the harms that we think will occur from Bill C-36. So, for example, in relation to this piece around 213, which is communication in public spaces, which has now been reduced to public spaces where specifically children would be present. We sort of said, like, it sort of suggests that sex workers don't have ethics, that they solicit in these places in the first place, which I doubt they actually do, and we don't really hear about that very often. And also it sort of positions sex workers as threats to communities as rather than parts of communities. So we see it as very contradictory to this idea that we're, as a society, we should be helping and supporting sex workers. So, in no way would criminalizing be a help to sex workers. We also talked about how criminalizing buyers actually puts sex workers at risk, too, because these are parties that are in interaction. So whatever happens to one, in a way, happens to the other. So if buyers feel worried about being in public, which they are generally anyway, but if they have even more fear around and need to evade the police, so that's not necessarily going to affect the kinds of context that sex workers work in as well. So they're going to have to match that that fear, and they're going to have to, you know, work with their buyers in order to stay out of public view and not run the risk of being arrested. So that places sex workers in greater danger, for sure. And so people have said, like, it just pushes the sex industry underground. It displaces it. It moves it to even less kind of public places where help may not be available. Advertising, I mean, we do disagree with the prohibition on advertising, because advertising is really important to sex workers. It's part of the whole kind of package of things that are done in terms of setting, like, screening and setting the terms of service with sex buyers. So for indoor workers, for example, like, advertisements will typically say, this is what I'm willing to do, these are kind of like the fees, this is when I'm available. And it's sort of that first layer of matching, you know, yourself with somebody who is going to be respectful and want the kinds of services that you offer. And then through the advertisement, people will then go on to, like, connect with a client and have more further conversation. So advertising is really still part of that sort of package of communication that needs to happen to sort of ensure health and safety in terms of delivering services. Mm-hmm. And, again, like, a really important point is that if buyers are all criminalized, they're less likely to give over. Like, usually people want some small piece of identifying information. So, for example, you'll typically hear people say they won't accept calls from blocked or private numbers. So they want a phone number, at least, or they want to know a little something about the address or whatever it happens to be. And so it's going to be, buyers are not going to want to go give over that information in a criminalized environment where they could be arrested. Mm-hmm. And, research shows that buyers actually are some of the people that come across information around, you know, if a sex worker is being abused or if there's a situation that doesn't look right. And so it also eradicates the possibility for them to go to police and, report information about the sex industry that might be useful to know. Prohibition on advertising is really problematic. One of the things, like, I do research on management in escort agencies and massage spas, so I was really disappointed to see the information which essentially, completely outlaws commercial enterprises, because I think these are a relatively safe option for people to work in. And, I mean, I'm quite safe, actually. Mm-hmm. So if you're in the industry and you want to go work in a group environment where you've got reception support that does some of the pre-screening of clients for you, in places that offer kind of in-call settings, you can bring clients into a setting where you've got other people around you, but you've got a private space to do your work. Mm-hmm. Someone's providing safer sex supplies. You've got drivers. You've got the camaraderie of other people around you that work that you can sort of debrief with at the end of the day. And I just don't see any reason whatsoever that we would want to outlaw this kind of a sex work venue. Mm-hmm. which has been, like, empirically shown to be safe. So that part just really made no sense to me. I mean, they kind of took care to make it the case where somebody could work independently and not sort of run afoul of the law. I suppose outlawing these commercial enterprises fits with their overall goal to eradicate the sex industry over time, but in the meantime, they're really complicating what's essentially a safe space for people to work a lot of the time.
So many critics of the hearing were saying that the government was conflating sex work with human trafficking and sexual exploitation, which Bedford versus Canada doesn't really threaten the laws around human trafficking. Is this something that you observed while at the hearings?
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. So they wouldn't even acknowledge that the possibility that there could be consensual sexual exchange between adults of a commercial nature. So any time that there was points brought up about this, they would go back to, you know, talking about the youth, the children, talking about trafficking, talking about all sorts of crimes that actually exist within our criminal code right now and that weren't part of what was being debated in Bedford. And so basically they, you know, it was very, very obvious and systematic that the Conservative government just wasn't really interested in considering that aspect of the sex industry. They wanted to, they definitely made it like a homogenous thing, and their primary point of view was sexually exploited youth, you know, which makes it very difficult to then talk about adults in the sex industry because doesn't leave a lot of room for that. So, yeah, it was really disappointing. Like, not any consideration, I would say, of the, you know, many, many years of good social science around factors that influence the health and safety of sex workers, what kinds of venues and supports can support health and safety. No consideration of New Zealand, so they kept going back to saying that our options between doing with Bill C-36, we're doing nothing as Canadians, which just isn't acceptable, or doing something. And the something is Bill C-36, which is just not true. There's so many options. There's so many legal models. And New Zealand is certainly one of them. And there's very good reasons why we would consider whether a model like that could work in Canada, but it wasn't considered, you know, very much glossed over. And it was a weird conversation to be having because it wasn't a real conversation.
The bill was mainly on the table because it was the Supreme Court essentially forced the hand of the government, and it came in during a particular political climate of conservatism. So how do you think this is affecting the bill and a bill that has such wide ramifications for the future and for people's security and safety?
Yeah, well, it's just the timing is unfortunate, and the bill, I believe, will pass because we have a conservative majority, and they're not, like I said, they're absolutely not even open to considering research. They're not open to considering the perspectives of sex workers. They're not unaware that this stuff exists out there, and they've completely locked themselves off from, which I just feel is so irresponsible because we should never be setting, you know, public policy going to affect the health, safety, you know, the lives of a very, you know, in many cases, marginalized population, and not considering research, not considering the advocacy groups that speak for these people. So, but I think it's going to pass, and, you know, we'll have to deal with that, and I think there'll be further challenges. Hopefully the next time it comes around, we've got a government in place that's, you know, more willing to work with evidence-based policy and devise all of it, evidence-based policy, yeah.
Instead of Bill C-36, what would you like to advocate? What type of bill would you like to see put forward to the Canadian government?
I wouldn't necessarily say I have all the answers. What I would have liked to have seen is, I don't think they need to do anything to replace those laws that were struck down. I mean, they didn't really need to do anything at all. And if we were going to have anything in place in Canada, I think we should be looking at what's working well in New Zealand. I mean, certainly that's the way the research is pointing, is that's a better model.
Can you quickly outline that model for people who might not be, like, aware of it?
Oh, okay. So they have a different government structure, so it's true that we can't replicate it in Canada because they have a different sort of, structure of government and powers of different layers of government. So in Canada, our federal government can only deal with criminal law. And then when we get to health, that's more at a provincial level. And then when we get to, like, business license, that's a municipal level. Mm-hmm. We'd have to think about it differently in Canada anyway. But what they have there is a series of kind of municipal and health regulations mm-hmm. that so that enforce, like, or basically support sex workers to enforce safer sex practices. It allows sex workers to take complaints against employers forward. It discourages, abuses within the sex industry. It discourages youth sexual exploitation. But then it also, like, supports sex workers to run businesses and to run businesses in a decriminalized environment with the possibilities for taking complaints forward against sex buyers who, for example, don't refuse condoms or, like, managers of an escort agency, basic employment. So, I mean, I don't know exactly what that would look like in Canada and what the possibilities are given the way our employment laws are structured or the way, like, municipal regulations city. I would like the government to take some time to actually consult with sex worker organizations and researchers in this area and then try to develop something from that perspective rather than what they've done right now, which is really sort of emerged out of kind of perspective, not health and safety focused, not evidence-based.
Do you think that this maybe could have been addressed earlier by creating a clear distinction between what sex work is versus what sexual exploitation and human trafficking is? Like, that seems to be a main distinction that has been really glossed over in these hearings.
Yeah, absolutely. And they ought to be defining things like what a sexual service is, too, which they don't. So it leaves it wide open for interpretation as well. Like, I'm not even sure, you know what I mean, what would constitute sex work in the bill. But I think everything that they don't like. So, like, that's the point of leaving it open and not defining it in a way. But, so that it gives basically courts an opportunity to define it in practice. But, yeah, of course it would have been better if they had considered the sex industry to be something that's differentiated, that, contains abuses as well as, like, on the other end of the spectrum, people who are in very situations that they consider empowering and abusive. So, but they, the federal government was not interested. That's not their view on this. No inclination or desire to actually create conceptualizations or definitions of these kinds of things. So when peers went to hearings, there was a number of people that came forward to say, I chose to be in the sex industry. We brought some quotes forward from, like, members of our organization around people saying, like, what were the complicated or different kinds of circumstances that brought them into the sex industry, and how do they feel about the sex industry? How do they feel about their clients in the sex industry? And people were just kind of dismissed and sort of disparaged for bringing these kind of alternate viewpoints forward in the context of the hearing. So it was very discouraging.
Right. So what would you like to see going forward, and what work will peers be doing going forward in relation to this bill?
So some of the things peers is doing, we're participating we're a community partner to the Understanding Sex Work. Well, it's the website is understandingsexwork.ca, and it's out of the Center for Addictions Research, and it's led on. This is a big, complex study of the sex industry, looking at it from the perspectives of sex buyers, managers — that's where I did the manager research — sex sellers, intimate partners of sex workers, and regulators, law enforcement. So we'll stay, involved in that and kind of the findings that are emerging from that. We're looking at what the Senate process looks like. So now the bill has gone through the Justice, goes to the Senate now. And it seems like they might take some briefs and maybe possibly some witnesses again. So we'll see. We're meeting with some of our members, see how we might participate in that process as well. And then we're also just collecting information from people about what their questions are about how Bill C-36 is going to affect their lives, and we'll try to get some answers. So we know, some things about what, in the broad strokes, about what's going to be prohibited through Bill C-36, but there's still, like, when you get down to the level of daily practice, like, people still have questions about, okay, well, does that mean that I can put this on my website, or does that mean that I can, I work in an agency, what does that mean for our agency? And people still don't really know the answers to that, because it's legislation, right? It still has to be enacted. Mm-hmm. So, some of that information is going to emerge in over time. So we want to be sort of conduits to getting information out to the sex industry community area, and then probably meeting with other, like, sort of allied partners that share our interests. So we meet with police and just, hopefully mitigate the harmful impact here, at least in this region. And then we're connected with a number of sex work organizations across Canada, so then we'll do what we can.
Last time I talked with Marion Little, who was then the director, we were talking about being underfunded by the government. How is Pierce doing now? Are you guys getting more funding? I know your door's open again because of donors and the community. How is Pierce Society doing as a whole?
We got a bit of money in the spring. We got $100,000 from Justice and Attorney General, and so that's got us open under sort of part-time operations, I guess, until next spring, and we're applying for a lot of grants. We just got a housing grant. We've had some successes with grants, and we're applying for some more over the fall. So things are okay at the moment, and, you know, we'll have a better idea next spring. But I think we feel pretty hopeful, actually. Like, we feel like there's a lot of support for peers in the community and for the kind of work that we do and the perspective that we take. So I don't know, I feel very encouraged, but, you know, in reality, our funding's still precarious a little bit, you know. So.
Well, I hope all the best to Peers Society to continue their work in the community. And I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me today, even with a little bit of our technical glitches here.
Yeah, I hope it works out.
Yeah.
My name is Jen Harmer, and today I'm talking with Dr. Annalee Lepp, who is an associate professor and chair of the Women's Studies Department here at University of Victoria. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in human trafficking?
I started working on the issue of human trafficking in 1996, and there were two things that happened. One is that Jyoti Singera, who is a colleague in the Department of Women's Studies, was very much involved with the Global Alliance Against Trafficking Women, whose international secretariat is in Bangkok, Thailand. And so she invited me to become involved in the work that the Global Alliance was doing. The second thing that happened is that in 1997, 1998, there were a series of massive massage parlor raids in Toronto. And they were called Project Orphan and Project Trade. These police raids always have project names. So it was Project Orphan and Project Trade. And basically what was happened was that there were massive sweeps of massage parlors and apartment-style brothels and the arrest of mainly Thai women, but also Malaysian women who were working in the massage parlors. And so we got involved in a major intervention there because it was very clear that the discourse of human trafficking was just beginning to sort of emerge in Canada. And so they were seen as victims of trafficking, but simultaneously they were being arrested and they were charged with prostitution and immigration related charges. And so we did on the ground work with them, making sure that they had legal representation, interpreters, places to live, and those kinds of things. And so that was our real sort of major beginning of crisis intervention work in this particular case. Most of the women were deported eventually. Some were in detention for as long as a year. And so we saw from a state perspective that there were a lot of human rights violations happening against the women themselves. And so we began this work and increasingly over the years have really focused on monitoring policy and legislation at the federal government level, what's happening at the provincial level, doing crisis intervention when necessary, doing advocacy, doing public awareness, and then also doing research. And our latest research project was done on the 2010 Vancouver Olympic Games. And what we looked at there is that there is this common mythology out there that as soon as you have a major sporting event, there's going to necessarily be an increase in trafficking. And so we did an extensive study, interviewed about 62 people, organizations, to find out if indeed there was an increase in human trafficking during the 2010 Vancouver Olympic Games. And so that was a major study, and we found that no, like previous Olympic Games and major sporting events, there wasn't an increase in human trafficking for the purposes of sexual exploitation, which is the main focus of the debate.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. Why is there a mythology that there will be an increase in trafficking around these sporting games?
Basically, the assumption is that major sporting events, there's a rise in male demand for paid sexual services, and that traffickers will capitalize on that rise in demand by trafficking women into the sex industry to service that male demand. What we found is, and even the FIFA World Cup in 2006, which was the major sort of debating point in the major sporting events, that one, there was not an increase in male demand for paid sexual services during sporting events, even sort of more male, masculine-focused events like soccer tournaments. In fact, sex workers said there wasn't an increase in business at all, much to their disappointment because they were hoping to make lots of money. But indeed, that the fans, the male fans, were there to watch the games, mm-hmm. drink beer with their friends and watch the games. And this has been the assumption. And so it's really an assumption that is based on a demand-driven kind of thinking, which really segues into sort of debates about prostitution and trafficking.
Mm-hmm. So before we go further, can you define human trafficking?
I think that the definition of human trafficking is really, really important because there's a lot of debate around the definition, and there's a lot of sensationalism in the media around human trafficking, especially if it's for the purposes of sexual exploitation. Lots of sensationalism, and I think a lot of misinformation. So if we look at the international definition that came into force in 2003, and if we look at Canada's Criminal Code and also the provisions under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, it's very clear that trafficking is a crime against the person that involves three elements. The first element is a set of actions. There needs to be a form of recruitment or transportation of a person. Secondly, there's a means by which those actions are carried out. So these means would include things like coercion, force, abuse of authority, deception. And then thirdly, there is an end purpose, which is generally forced labor, forced servitude. So it's these three elements. In the case of minors or children, then the second element doesn't apply. If a child is found in a situation of forced labor or sexual exploitation, then it doesn't necessarily have to, the elements of threat or coercion don't apply. But for adults, those three elements need to be in place in order for human trafficking to have occurred. So trafficking can happen into any labor site. Everything from agriculture to the construction industry, there's a begging industry, there's manufacturing, domestic service. But I think that what we know is that since the 1980s and 1990s, when this latest round of discourses and attention to human trafficking has emerged, the main focus of laws, policies, and campaigns have focused on the sex industry. So that has been really, really clear. And it's only very recently, for example, in the Canadian context, where the federal government is looking more closely at the temporary workers program and other industries for the potential or the existence of situations of forced labor.
Mm-hmm. So just to clarify two things, you said that the second condition, the means of action or coercion or deception, doesn't apply to kids. What is that age cutoff? Would that be 18?
Yeah,
18. Okay.
Yeah.
And so why is the sex industry so sensationalized in the media? Is it because people feel it's kind of an affront to social morality or these general norms? Or because it seems to me that it would be a smaller percentage of people are trafficked into sex trafficking, and there's a lot more people in kind of domestic or migrant work So do you have any understanding of what the proportions are of people who are trafficked into the sex industry versus other industries?
Well, internationally, I think what the literature tends to suggest is that most trafficking happens into the context of the labor market or for labor exploitation. And then there is a proportion that for sexual exploitation, but labor seems to be the higher proportion. In the Canadian context, I think one thing to clarify is that trafficking can occur across borders, transnational trafficking, as we call it, and also domestically. And in the Canadian context, prior to about 2005, most of the focus was on transnational trafficking. And transnational trafficking for the purposes of sexual exploitation in the sex industry. That was the primary focus of a lot of the federal initiatives, and also NGOs were really focusing on that. And, you know, police would continue to raid massage parlors and residential brothels in order to uncover human trafficking, which they were not very successful at. So there are the two kinds. But in 2005, domestic trafficking, really focusing on the sex industry alone, domestic trafficking has really become the focus of attention of really high-profile anti-trafficking advocates, politicians. There's a proliferation of NGOs that are focusing on the issue of trafficking, domestic trafficking for the purpose of sexual exploitation. So the debate here is around, so some would argue that transnational trafficking for the purposes of labor exploitation into the agricultural industry or into the construction industry is sort of mundane, right? It's mundane, you know, that migrant workers are exploited is something that does not make a Hollywood movie. Trafficking for the purposes of sexual exploitation, I don't know if you saw the film The Whistleblower, you know, it makes for a very sensationalist, and all of the anti-trafficking films of this sort are graphically violent, gratuitous violence, which I have such a huge problem with, in order to register the fact that society abhors, you know, this practice. So the exploitation of migrant workers, yeah, people get upset about it, but simultaneously the sexual exploitation of young women is something that people get outraged about. And hence, I think the focus and also the sensationalism, because there is a lot of, you know, usage of language that is really problematic, like sex slavery and sex slaves that people use on an everyday basis, which I find very problematic, because unless a person sort of defines themselves as a sex slave, I don't think that that sort of language should be used. But simultaneously, I think that sexual exploitation has been sensationalized for two reasons. One, to register outrage. And two, because human trafficking for sexual exploitation has become embroiled in the more general prostitution debates.
Right. So can you explain the difference between sexual exploitation, sex work, and prostitution?
So in the international trafficking definition, prostitution is mentioned and sexual exploitation is mentioned. And both of these are left undefined in the UN definition of trafficking, and partly because different nation states have different laws around prostitution, so they did not want to sort of impose a definition. So prostitution is generally a term that is used in the criminal code, for example. It's the historical term used to describe the exchange of money for sexual services. Sexual exploitation is broader insofar as that, you know, it's the not so much coerced exchange of sexual services. It doesn't have to be for money. It could be for gifts. It could be for other things. So there's an exchange of sexual services, but there's an element of coercion involved. And generally, sexual exploitation also applies to minors without many questions asked. Sex work is a term that emerged also in the 1980s and 90s when the sex workers' rights movement all over the world emerged that was attempting or has attempted to really promote sex workers' rights, sex worker safety, sex worker dignity, struggles against stigmatization of sex workers, better working conditions. And in many respects, they see the criminal laws against prostitution as being an obstacle to sex worker safety. And that's really what the recent Ontario court challenge against the prostitution laws, Bedford versus Canada, is about. Because what the appellants argued was that the prostitution laws of operating a body house, communication laws, and living off of the avails of prostitution undermine their rights of security of person under the Charter of Human Rights. So that's basically what the case is about. Where things get complicated, though, is that there are two groups battling out in the prostitution debates. One, that we call the prohibitionists, they argue that female prostitution is inherently violence, exploitation, So in there, they conceptualize all women who are in the sex industry as de facto victims of trafficking. So that's one side. And what they argue is that they're arguing, adamantly arguing for the Nordic model, which would be a reform of Canada's prostitution laws where you decriminalize the sex worker. The sex worker would no longer be criminalized in terms of communication laws and living off of the avails and operating a body house, but you criminalize male demand.
Because right now in Canada, it is legal to, prostitution is legal. I don't think a lot of people realize that.
Prostitution is legal, but everything that you do is illegal, right? So communication is a key one, particular for on-street sex workers, operating a body house or living off the avails, or it mainly apply to indoor workers.
The body house is really important because you couldn't have two sex workers sharing an apartment, because if they both brought home clients at the same time, it would be considered a body house, and thus they could be arrested. But that decreases their safety and their ability to have safe housing and security of persons.
Yeah. And living off of the avails would apply to anyone that, you know, is an associate of a sex worker, including family members, right? And so in many respects, so there's the one group that are arguing for the Nordic model that say that we want the eradication of the entire sex industry. And we see getting to that goal requires that we decriminalize the sex worker, because they're all victims of human trafficking, and we criminalize male demand, which includes clients and any third-party involvement. And they would see the third parties as pimps and traffickers. That's what they call them. So in all of the sort of reviews of Canada's prostitution laws, there was the review of the solicitation laws in 2005 and the current Bedford case. This has been a significant voice in arguing for the enactment of the Nordic model in Canada. On the other hand, sex workers' rights advocates, activists, and groups argue that it's the criminal laws, it's the criminalization of sex work that really shapes the unsafe conditions and, you know, enhances the vulnerability of sex workers, because in order to avoid police, sex workers are moved into more isolated areas. Their negotiation with clients is done more quickly under those circumstances. And basically, the criminalized environment undermines sort of safety strategies that sex workers employ to keep themselves safe and so forth. It also registers that sex workers are other, right? And in some ways sort of suggest that, you know, they're legitimate targets of abuse and exploitation, has been the argument. So needless to say, in all of this, sex workers argue that, of course, exploitation and force and coercion is unacceptable in any labor site. But simultaneously, they argue for decriminalization, which would basically be the repeal of the prostitution-related laws, the application of generic criminal code protection laws against assault, confinement, abduction, and all of those things that people are concerned about in the anti-trafficking world. And then finally, the application of basic labor laws and business codes to sex worker activity. The long and short of it is basically that human trafficking has become central in these debates, and it has become a trope in many respects for saying that we need to maintain the status quo, a criminalized environment in terms of the sex industry, that we need to impose the Nordic model in order to eradicate the sex industry because all female sex workers are trafficking victims. And for sex workers, they argue that to address force and coercion and exploitation within the industry, there needs to be a decriminalized strategy in order to address working conditions. The other argument, too, is that those who argue that all women who are in the sex industries are victims of trafficking, they ignore the diverse experiences of those working in the sex industry, which includes, yes, women, it includes men, and it also includes trans people.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's a bit of a conflation of the ideas between victim versus a worker and the choice between choosing to be a sex worker versus being forced and to be sexually exploited.
There is, you know, the debate hinges on that sex work is inherently abusive and exploitative, mm-hmm. and a form of violence against women. It's seen as an obstacle to gender equality. Mm-hmm. And for sex workers' rights advocates, they see it as a form of labor, as an income-generating activity. Right. So these are very different concepts of what it means to exchange sexual services for money.
Is there kind of a concern that I'm not clear if people who are advocating for sex workers' rights are advocating for legalization? Because you didn't necessarily say that. You said to have protection as if it were a labor, like a job. My thought is that would people argue that through making it normalized in society, could traffickers use that to their advantage by trafficking people through those places that where it is more common, like, for example, higher rates of trafficking through Amsterdam because it is legalized there?
So that's the debate. I mean, the debate is around evidence. Mm-hmm. So the Nordic model has been introduced in Sweden, and basically what prohibitionists argue is that it has a chilling effect on human trafficking. But at the same time, basically, if you look closely at the Nordic model was, or the Swedish model was introduced in Sweden in 1999, basically it was an anti-immigration tool. What they did not want was, the Soviet Union had recently opened, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall and opened its borders, and so they did not want to have a flood of migrant sex workers in Sweden. So the chilling effect was actually an anti-migration, and nobody talks about it. It was an anti-migration tool. Simultaneously, what they have found is that in terms of domestic sex workers in Sweden, that the industry has gone underground. So certainly there are less sex workers working on street in the larger cities in Sweden, but they've moved to the suburbs, and most of the sex industry is indoors. So the argument is actually it has not done what it is intended to do, which is eradicate prostitution, which is the end purpose. And simultaneously, for those sex workers working on street, they are working under more dangerous conditions, more isolated. The transactional issues are the same as a criminalized environment, and that the workers basically work within a criminalized environment, even though they're not the target, right? Mm-hmm. So there is this debate. If you look at Holland and Germany, which have a legalized environment, yes, there are those that argue that there has been a huge increase in trafficking in the context of a legalized environment, which is basically state regulation of the sex industry. And most sex workers' rights advocates do not like legalization because it requires that you register with the state as a sex worker. There are mandatory health checks and those kinds of things. But it is true that in Germany and Holland there are a lot of migrant sex workers, but if you argue that all sex workers in the industry are trafficked, then you would see every migrant sex worker as a trafficked person. So it depends on how you apply the definition of human trafficking to say whether those areas are conducive to an increase in trafficking, and everybody's arguing about the evidence, right? So, but decriminalization is different insofar as, and it's been introduced in New Zealand. It's not perfect, but what it does is it removes the criminal code provisions. It allows for the application of labor laws and business codes and nuisance laws, et cetera, to the sex industry. And it allows for the application of generic criminal code provisions that are the concern of those who are concerned about violence and exploitation in the sex industry. We have bazillions of laws in the criminal code against assault, confinement, abduction, kidnap, you know, all of those things are there, and they should be applied to protect sex workers as they are applied to the general population.